your conversations. I'm sure you're talking about your paper or something. I already got one here. Somebody's got no worries now. I had to pile it all together the last two or three days.
What did you all think of Don Wright the other day? What do you think about his point of view? Well, I just thought that he, frankly, I was saying, I was a little surprised that he accepted that point of view. He had done to me, I sort of helped do to him. got on the phone and say, hey, we got to do this, I'll do this. But I just thought that he was somebody that could be exposed to.
I was thinking about it today, and I was thinking that apparently what happened would be a lot of the things that we organized and we voted for. And there was a power structure, and we reorganized in a better way. That was a really good thing for him to allow things to happen.
Anticipated that there would be a problem, you see. We went along for some years trying to function with an unwieldy board that we had created out of just in the effort to create some type of organization. We had to kind of keep it open to everybody.
So we set it up so that we had individual memberships in the federation. We had representation out there. We had urban associations out there, and we had regional groups. We had village groups. In fact, we had a group called the Fire Chiefs Yakutat that Byron Malott said he represented. Well, we didn't know if there were five chiefs of Yakutat or who they were. You know? So we put Byron on there. But as things got real hot and heavy on this and trying to get the settlement through, we had to come up with some mechanism for something like a tribe or something, you know, something that sort of represented what we had been working with, which is all these different groups. And we had to have sometimes a week on end board meetings of the old AFN association. Well, the association was unincorporated. And sometimes we'd have to go all the way to Washington with a group of that size trying to hold the whole thing together. But in the process of negotiating with the Congress, we had to, we ended up with all these different groups, and then when we had to incorporate, see, we never gave it that much thought that we were creating, in effect, two organizations. But it was generally understood by everybody that this old association was going to be sort of subsumed by the incorporated body. But that was simply a detail I didn't want to get into that big debate with Don about the organization, but he helped create AFN, But there was just some legalistic type of things involved there. And we didn't want to try to cut this group of 30 down to, we thought about maybe 24, just to cut it down, two from each region, but we pretty much created the 12 regional concepts. Which we simply were going to reorganize eventually, but we didn't want to do it in the process of this whole political effort to move the Congress. So we just kind of let it ride until, of course, after the settlement passed, and then we started to set up the cloud regional concept, which we've been working with ever since. But Don was saying that, well, we really had two organizations, you know, which was an old association that everybody sort of belonged to, which didn't have any particular, I guess it had a legal status, or it was just an association of individuals like us if we formed a group. And then because of all the money involved that we were administering, the federal government and we decided it would be safer to incorporate. So we wouldn't be individually liable for activities of this old association in case we got into trouble because of them. Anyway, it was this group that put me in and put him out. And step it away. But I think the other problem was this, that AFN simply would not have existed. I mean, the old AFN and the new AFN that he helped create as well, I think would not have been able to carry on, because Don always was barely hanging on during the last stages of the Settlement Act. It was terrible, really. I mean, he just barely had enough to stay in position. And in fact, I was always afraid of my flat part, and it really pushed the numbers. You know, as long as things were moving, you know, in Congress and the way we thought they ought to be going, we didn't try to cut him off at the knees then, you know, but by the time the act passed, you know, I mean, there was no incentive to keep him aboard, and everybody was concerned that he was going to take us in the wrong direction. And there was a necessity to regroup. And I think we would never been able to pay all that debt, that $300,000. I think many of the regions would have simply not remained members of the Federation. It was the main problem that I saw. And we had to get that debt paid to shape up the organization. But he was a controversy at that point, so that's it. Who were they? Oh, I don't know. It's always been left to each region to select its own leadership, power of fashion. Right? So that's one. Actually, now there's, you know, they have two boards. AFN has basically a joint board of what they call land claims and human resources. So there's 24 people on board. So one representing the region, one representing the social services, education, health, other programs. Well, the capper lives on this. The guy dealing with the money, he called the capitalists, and these people dealing with the government, he called the socialists. Terminology. A lot of the fellows from the regions who deal with the money, and you know, who might spend much time with the government, who they think are governmentally oriented, and bureaucratic types. But in any case, those were kind of tough times trying to hold the organizations together, because after so many years of working, having to work together when there was no real natural inclination to do so historically, then all of a sudden after the act passed, everybody went all different ways. Sort of left Dino in the bag there and try to pick it up and bring it back. But one of the better consequences of that political problem I had trying to keep the 12 regions together in the same organization was the United Bank of Alaska. Because I had so much of a problem trying to keep this thing together politically that I thought, well, if we could come up with some business venture, I thought the least I could do is bring these same regions together to deal with this business venture, and at the same time, talk about the problems of AFN and paying off that huge debt, which we ultimately did. You know, but I had to go to Congress to get some investment from the NASA today. But the United Bank of Alaska resulted from the political problems I had trying to hold AFN together back then. So we now have seven regions and one village. That own United Bank, which is one of the few interregionally owned business ventures that's been a success. Which I don't think, did Terry talk to you about United Bank at all? Well, I won't go into any detail, but it is an investment that was started with five regions using a capital of $600,000 each. And for a total of $3 million in capital. And our board consists primarily of people from different regions. But the bank now is in full wrap, it's about $120 million. And it has been profitable the last couple of years. But this is a business in which politically we had no opposition. There were some key Republicans who wanted competition in the banking arena. They wanted to see more banks chartered. So we came in at the right time, and we also came in during the high point of economic activity during the pipeline days back in 75. So 5 years later, we are about that size and started our first branch of Bethel. But that's not the subject I wanted to talk about today. Did any of you read the Anchorage Times yesterday? You remember the headline? What do you people do in college? Nobody's got time to read, huh? I mean, actually, I don't care to read. I don't generally get the Anchorage Times, frankly. I read the news. Sometimes I can't resist there's something special. But what did the headline say, John? Borough official fired?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we'd like to talk about is local government. And some of you may have read Macbeth's book on the North Slope Borough. Has anybody read that yet? Nobody's read that. What, if you don't read in college, what do you do? There's a little book out on it. Anyway, what I'd like to talk about a little bit is local government. And because you see, we've been involved with government. And then we've been involved in government, right? And long before state municipal government showed up, we dealt with the Fed, right? Because of the IRA. You all know what that is. That's the Indian Reorganization Act that created government entities, federal government entities, for the purpose of local tribal government or local government. And many of these were created throughout the state after 1936, particularly in the 40s, when the Interior Department attempted to try to institute the idea of reservations in Alaska. And under the IRA, they created tribal constitutions, or you can call them tribal constitutions, for each village. And they elected officers, they had rules, bylaws, but this was an entity that, of course, Alaska wasn't a state then, so it was an entity that had direct relationship with the federal government, generally through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You know, it was through these entities that they set up for not only reservations in some places, but also their village economic entity, generally a village store, or sometimes they run maybe a sawmill, something like that. In Southeast Alaska, they ran canneries. And these were institutions, the first early Western type institutions for management, you know, for village or for village government or village management or community management. Generally the school teachers were involved, you know, as part of their multifaceted function. You know, the Great White Father Complex I told you about. Well, they were the ones who had the responsibility for doing all this. And they wanted to try to institute some, it was an educational process as far as they, you know, it was a showing the great virtues of democracy, et cetera, you know, that they felt our people had to learn. And of course, still to this very day, we do have a situation where we have these different forms of local government still functioning, right? They're still alive and still legal. Now, these are still legal entities. Generally, the state has very little to do with how they function. It's a creature of the federal government. But of course, along comes statehood in 1959. And, you know, many of the people in the push simply didn't understand, just like when America sold Alaska to the Russians. Well, most of the native people didn't hear about it, right? Well, just like statehood, very few people in the bush understood what statehood was going to mean. You know, what did that transition mean for people that living out in the hinterlands? Well, we did have representation in the legislature, right? In the new legislature, way back then. In fact, we had a couple of native people heavily involved in the politics of the territory and the state. We had people like Bell, an Eskimo guy, who was the first president of the Senate after statehood. We had Carraveris. I guess he was first, or was it Carraveris? We had Frank Carraveris, who was an Indian from Pawak, I think it is, who was also in the Senate. And we had people like Evan Hoffman, people like, well, in the territorial base, the archives started participating, not just in the federal type of political activity, but also in the territorial or state. And so they had to start responding to what was going on with the new state. And of course, the state began to create a form of local government called the borough. And of course, they passed what was called the Mandatory Borough Act. The state just didn't have the resources to make it work by itself, so they passed this local mandatory borough government, which in effect was forcing local government, area-wide or regional local government, on certain parts of the state that they felt could afford to take care of their own, a certain measure of their own expenses of running local government. Of course, what was not included in the Mandatory Borough Act was the unorganized borough. So that was everything outside the white towns, right? The bush, the villages. And except for Natick, which had some canneries there that they were going to tax, I guess. So after 1959, Hobson and the Phyllis from the bush began, you know, to have to deal with the question of local government. Well, the way things were set up, there was no real way for village governments to participate in the state. They're sort of creatures of the federal government here, most of them, if they had anything going. And so they passed it was called the Village Incorporation Act. Which would allow communities, primarily native communities, I guess, then, or other towns, a chance to participate in the new state, to become political creatures of the state. Of course, many of them didn't do that. I mean, they didn't have any compunction to do that. The state wasn't doing anything for communities back then anyway. Right? And the federal government was doing some, but not that much. See, the villages' primary contact was with the federal government through the BIA. In fact, the state's position, following statehood, was that, well, the villages are a problem of the feds. You know? They are wards of the government. You know, we don't have the money to spend on them anyway, so let's just concentrate on the boroughs, on the urban communities, and let the federal government handle the bush. That was pretty much the attitude when I came there in 66. But we had nothing going, in effect, in the unorganized borough, insofar as the state was concerned. But when the state got a bunch of money, $900 million to spend, that was the first time, of course, anybody thought, well, maybe we should spend a little bit out there too. But large towns like Barrow, Kotzebue, generally the initiative for creating local government out there was in the non-native community. That's how the city of Kotzebue got organized. Because even so late as the 40s and 50s, dealing with this kind of thing was almost beyond our comprehension. It just wasn't a part of our consciousness, right? Dealing with local government and all that sort of thing. But that late, just nobody was particularly interested. We were all busy trying to survive. So the initiative generally came from whites who were accustomed to, you know, dealing with cities, local government, some kind of local mechanisms. And so many of the villages simply didn't pay much attention to even the village incorporation. And the reason that I invited John Buckle here was I think that he probably knows the story about the North Slope Borough and has lived a great portion of it. He knows the story as well as anybody. And Evan Hobson was involved in some of the earliest legislation affecting Village Alaska. And I was in the Senate at the time that they began to utilize the law on local governments to create the North Slope Borough. And at the time, it was just about the time the pipeline was being built, or about to be built, in the process of being built, perhaps, I forget. But there was a question as to how to tax that pipeline. You know, should local governments, you know, along the pipeline route have the opportunity to tax whatever portion of the pipeline was in their borough boundaries? Or should the state attempt to tax it themselves and then redistribute that income from those taxes to the municipalities, not only along the pipeline, but throughout the state? Well, one of the thoughts I had at that time was to try to utilize this opportunity over this controversy to take portions of the money derived from this tax on the pipeline and give it to the unorganized borough. Because I always felt that in some fashion we should be able to determine in the rural areas, no planning, zoning, etc. And I thought that without having to go through the full process of instituting everything you're supposed to with the local government, that we simply get planning and zoning powers to preempt, you know, control, because ultimately we'd have to live within that region in any case. And, you know, why leave it to the legislature, which is ultimate government, I guess, in the state, to decide how they're going to handle those areas. And so we tried, and I was serving on local government committee in the Senate then, tried to figure out a way to do this, to take, you know, a few million dollars a year to appropriate to people in, say, the Northwest area or the Nome area, wherever, in the bush they had a natural grouping of communities, to have them do their own planning and zoning and eventually evolve into local government. Well, about that time, the North Slope boroughs initiated their effort to secure a local government, which of course appalled the industry. And at the same time, I could see that in the governor's office, there was a real problem with the idea as well. It just so happened that Evan Hobson was working for Governor Egan at the time. And so somehow we ended up talking to each other about this. And I could see that John Havelock, who was the Attorney General, was including in his calculations the value, the entire value of the pipeline, including that portion that was to be in Prudhoe Bay. And I got the distinct impression that he wanted to redistribute those funds and not give those people up there a chance to form their own local government. So I got down on the floor of the Senate and I made this special speech, and I didn't have any facts, right? I just had this feeling that the Attorney General, and I didn't attack the governor directly, I just said that the Attorney General was attempting to scuttle the possibilities of local government in the North Slope area. Anyway, he said it was all wrong, et cetera, et cetera, but I knew I saw his numbers. I saw what he was doing. Because to me, what he was saying was that he was hoping that this other thing didn't occur. At least that was a message to me. So what I decided to do was invite John, who has been very close with Evan Hobson for many years, and have him talk to you about local government and the politics of local government in the borough. And you can ask him whatever you want to. He always tells what's on his mind. I have no question that he's probably going to attack me in the process. So you'll have John Bumble speak. Okay, John?
Yeah, right. Well, Evan Hobson is considered the organizer and founder of the borough and local government. He was, he's a leader from the time he took on the schools, BIA school up there, was using kids on work projects that should have gone, he felt, to people with families, and these kids were being worked for free. So he led a kind of a strike and wrote a letter to the superintendent of the BIA complaining about that, and they became identified as a troublemaker from that point on. I think he was around 13, 14. After he finished school, they wouldn't let him, he was a good student too, but they wouldn't let him go to school because he was a troublemaker. Keep him home, and he stayed home until he was around 19, got married, and about the 8th month of his pregnancy, he was the only, well, I think one of three people drafted in Barrow to go to war. And he wasn't ever to come home to see his first kid for 3 years. His kid was 3 years old when he got home. And he thought perhaps then, after the war, he would like to get into preaching, but he was a little young for that. And he was discouraged, and so he got into local government. Local government, like Willie said, had been kind of a BIA operation, kind of like student body government is. And never really dealt with anything really important. And after the war, of course, it was before statehood, A lot of people don't understand that one of the consequences of World War II was this incredible invasion of Beryl with invasion craft. I mean, one day, and I talked to people who were young at the time, she told me, a woman at the office told me that one day the village went to the beach to find that the entire water out there was just full of landing craft. It was coming up, and they landed, and people got off, and they announced that they were going to build a Navy base there. And a couple of years later, they discovered gas nearby, and they piped the gas into what had what became the federal school and all the other federal, during the war, a lot of federal agencies went up to open up shop. After all, it was the northernmost part of the nation. Particularly in the, after World War II, the Arctic coast became a main battleground in the Cold War, as we ring the coast with every 50 miles with an installation to an early warning system, you know, for communications and to spot the attack when it came. A lot of construction in that time, but very little government. Eben was in local government, though, at the time, and he discovered that the city government was a great vehicle to use in trying to get the Navy to change their mind about their refusal to let Beryl connect with gas. And the people saw gas being piped by their houses, but they couldn't connect themselves. They had to use coal, or they had to go up and make some pitch blocks out of saturated tundra near where there were seeps, that kind of thing. But they couldn't use gas. And I think, I've always thought that that was probably the struggle, a 12-year struggle on the part of Beryl using their local government to connect to gas. And in the process, they learned how to deal with the territorial government and all the way back to Washington, and were successful in getting special legislation passed after 12 years of struggle. They got, in the 50s, a permission to connect to gas. And they set up, I suppose, the first municipal organization of any power called Beryl Utilities, which piped the gas to people's homes. And with gas, they were able to generate their own electricity and so forth. And the city of Beryl continued. Statehood happened. And Eben Hobson went into politics. He was in the territorial house. You have to understand that in territorial days, there was a lot of frustration. There wasn't any provision for local government anywhere in the state, except for Anchorage and some of the larger places, and they had a special federal charter to organize home rule governments. There wasn't any home rule anywhere else in the state. A lot of frustration taken out. One of your former teachers here, Vic Fisher, who's elected to the Senate now from Anchorage, chaired the local government committee on the Constitutional Convention, and they really got real specific, provided that it would be easy to organize local government in Alaska if you could get the agreement of your neighbors. And of course, the attitude towards local government in Alaska then as now was rather redneck, the less the better, because people didn't like to pay taxes. And so it was assumed that you could make it easy. People of good sense wouldn't want to organize local government anyway. Hobson, having started his political career in local government in Beryl, paid close attention to both the Constitutional Convention and the provisions contained in the Constitution when we became a state, and to the workings of the appropriate committee in the Senate. He was in the first state Senate, as they whipped together the first municipal code laws which would implement the Constitution, and they provided for a number of governments, city governments, borough governments of several classes, a municipal code under which the local government would then operate. And he remembered that all very carefully, and during the early 60s it was said, well, we'll have local government in rural Alaska when we have resource development to tax. And that was kind of it was a guarantee. Everybody knew that, but it was more of a slogan than anything else, except for Hobson. And he remembered. Now, during the land claims, when they organized the land claims, of course, every region takes credit for having started the land claims. But the loudest credit for having started the land claims is shouted by Beryl, and Charlie Edwardson. We'll tell you that he's the one who recruited Willie into the land claims. He told him how to draw a line on the map and sent him to Considine to do it. According to him, Willie stumbled around, got some people to draw lines on the map, and they became. Well, the land claims was a kind of a three-pointed sword up north, and it was organized by the Arctic Slope Native Association and had a lot of leaders. The thing about Barrow has lots of leaders, and much of this leadership was hewn, you know, sharpened in the National Guard. I was reading Gerald McBee's book about the North Slope Borough, and I feel that he's failed to appreciate the politics of the National Guard. Those of us who are associated with the land claims movement in the 60s always felt the National Guard was a bit Uncle Tom. We weren't really involved, we felt, in the land claims movement. And we wondered what the National Guard really was. It was winding down from becoming one of the most social, one of the most important statewide Native social institutions in the state in the 60s. And of course, under Hickel, he threw all the Natives out, except the enlisted men, so that he could provide jobs for his white officer buddies just retiring from the Army. Hobson was a captain in the National Guard. Would have been, I'm told, the first state senator, president of the first state senate, except he marched at Kennedy's inauguration rather than staying home, and so they gave the job to Clinkett from the southeast, much to his annoyance. Hobson, yeah. They let him go to the sixth grade. He tells a story about how he packed his, of course he heard that that they weren't going to let him go, but nobody ever told him straight out, you see. And what happened then is that the North Star would come up, and then if you got to go to school, you went down to the beach with your family, and everybody was thrilled because, my God, you're going to go on this incredible journey that only a few people had heard about. And it started with this rowboat or something in which you were taken out to the North Star, right? In his case, he was to go to school in Anchorage at the BIA school there. That was his destiny. He had a Klutna. And of course, he was the brightest kid. He could write very well. I've seen some stuff. He could write. He ran the community newspaper for the schools there, and I saw him, the stuff he's written when he was just a little kid. And so we went down, and the rest of the kids got on the boat. But nobody took Evans' bags and put them on the boat. And he knew what was up, but he wasn't going to say anything. He kept his impassive face. You know, he played muck. And he watched them load the other kids aboard in their bags and pushed off. And he sat down on his bag and waited for them to come back and get him. And he waited, and he waited, and it got dark. Finally, old Brower came down. So Brower was a good friend of Evan. He thought that old Brower, there was an old man up there. They used to call him the King of the Arctic, white guy. Used to be a whaler. Got rich up there as a trading post operator, and Evan was his favorite relative, one of his wife's relatives. And so they came down and said, "Evan, look," he said, "they're not going to let you go. I voted for you, but the rest of the white people who used to make decisions like that up there had voted against him. So he never got to go to school. That was it. Some people think that was the finest thing that ever happened to him. If he'd gone to school, in the white man's school, he would never have heard of Evan Hobson. But as it is, he escaped that brainwashing that would have rendered his life empty of the meaning that it had, seemingly. He escaped it. And he always said that it was a good thing, although he was always a little mad about it. Actually, his education was to be made up when he went into the Army. You know, he went to boot camp at the age of 19 in Nome. And they found him a good man, and they tried to make an orderly of him and bring him in, you know, because here's a man who was a kid, really, who could talk that white people like to hear Eskimos talk, you know. And so he finally got tired of it. He had been actually made a servant, indoor servant. So he asked for a transfer, and they made him they sent him to the Aleutian Chain, where he wound up being a bosun's mate aboard an army tug that used to ply up and back and forth in the Thousand Mile War. Anyway, he was gone for 3 years, and he came back in 46, I think. Came back in 1946 to Barrow, having left in 1943. That was basically his education. Before he died, some school back in the Midwest, certainly not the University of Alaska, only giving consequential twits PhDs, but some little school back in the Midwest finally gave him an honorary doctorate. Recognized here was a giant who's living among us, dishonored by the University of Alaska in more than one way. He was a white. He was a specialist in white sociology. Knew all about white people. Wasn't very white himself. White people never thought Evan was white enough. They always thought he was a little dumb because he was so Eskimo. You understand? He didn't come across as a sharp, with it individual. He was always very silent, very reserved, and very quiet about what he thought. And he wasn't a splashy young native leader back in the days when the land claims was being prosecuted. He's probably one of the oldest guys to get active in it. The rest of them were significantly younger than Evan when he was in it. Well, anyway, so he went to the AFN, and in my view, he and Willie put AFN on its feet financially so that there was money that what's-his-name could steal and settle the land claims with and go into debt with. And then he left. When Egan became governor again, he left and went to work as Egan's special advisor. It was from that point of view that he could cooperate with the Arctic Slope Native Association's simple passage of a petition asking for the borough to be organized so they could tax the oil and the pipeline at Prudhoe Bay. It wasn't just a pipeline. They wanted to tax the oil in place, as well as the machinery used to pump it up and so forth. I suppose there's many books you can read about how the oil companies responded against that. They tried to sue the state for letting it happen unsuccessfully, and then they went to the legislature. And just as Willie said, the evil person in the whole game was this fella, what the hell's his name, John Havelock, who I understand has been rewarded with a professorship here at the University of Alaska. Here's a man who not only begrudged the Eskimos the money that they might get from assessing property in the local government at Prudhoe Bay, but when it was allowed to happen, and there's nothing the oil companies could do about it in court, in 1973, they said to Governor Egan, look, unless you repeal all that legislation that you got the legislature to pass in 1972, right-of-way legislation, a model tax package model for the times, we're not going to build that pipeline. Then what you're going to do? You got a billionaire appetite now. You're about to run out of money. We're not going to build a pipeline. If we don't build that pipeline, and we're not going to until you repeal that legislation, you're going to go broke. So there. Egan panicked, and he said, well, okay, anything you want, you know. And so what they did is, in addition to the legislation to repeal the 1972 oil package, they tacked onto it, gratuitously, for no reason, no connection whatsoever, legislation to completely cancel out the North Slope Borough's tax authority at Prudhoe Bay. Leave the borough with no revenue authority at all. None. And they handed that to Havelock, and Havelock went along with it. As a matter of fact, he took the whole thing, the whole tax package, including this cancellation of the borough's revenue authority, was written by oil company attorneys, written by them, and changed not one whit by our attorney general, who handed them over to Egan and said, this, boss, is my recommendation. And that's the kind of man here we have, don't get me off on John Havelock, because the idiot came by about a year ago asking the North Slope Borough for work. Well, the borough didn't work. He was the attorney general at the time, just so you understand the political climate against which the borough had to and could only swim because of the strong feeling the drafters of the state constitution had about local government.
Before they got created, they had to go through the constitution. I think they should understand that while the borough's been around for a while, sort of accepted, but at the time that it was created, it had to meet the criteria that the oil company
said that this was merely a trick for the people of Barrow to say suddenly, well, we also live over at Prudhoe Bay. They didn't recognize or willing to recognize and went to court arguing against the regional integrity of the Inupiat people around Barrow. And finally, the court said, look, if there wasn't any other many compelling reasons, the one compelling reason would be that these people do live in a regional ecosystem. You know, in order to protect that, they have to have regional jurisdiction. And it just happens to include Prudhoe Bay in a community that stretches from the Canadian border and beyond, because the Inupiat community goes into Canada and includes all of the Inupiatawi, and over to Point Hope, about which there's some blurring of identification between Kotzebue and Barrow. And anyway, the courts upheld that. Then they went to court. Then they went to the legislature. Willie was in the legislature at the time, and they tried to pass legislation. Well, out of that came instead of losing revenue authority, the North Slope Borough wound up with the right to receive up to $1,000 per person from taxes at Prudhoe Bay. But the first time in the history of the United States, a state property tax was instituted and imposed on 20 mil property tax. In other words, you could be charged no more than 20 mils. And out of that levy, the borough would how local government started. That's how the state delivered on its promise that once resources were developed, local government would inevitably result. An instinctive denial of Americans' most sacred traditions, planning and zoning authority by the oil companies, who had learned their habits elsewhere, had bad habits elsewhere, and how to treat local folks. So I think that as we, in the future, as we judge the oil companies, we should look upon their reaction to the North Slope Borough as where they really live, because I see nothing change since. Yeah, I know. That's right. Well, the borough was organized. Money started pouring in from the tax base. Now, Hobson now had a big county-like government with a huge and expanding tax base, but a small and rather static population. He suddenly found out that he had great credit on the bond market. That was before now the money started disappearing and becoming worthless, but back in those days, in 1973, Hobson found out that he could go to the bond market and sell any number of bonds, raise any amount of money for, 5 or 6%? 40-year debt? Long bond, so he was able to raise all the money he wanted. And he took the position that the debt service on these bonds would not come out of the $1,000 per capita, so that resulted in the next legal skirmish between the state and the borough, and was subsequently decided by the state Supreme Court that the debt service was not included in the $1,000 limitation. So the North Slope Borough then is not just limited to the money per capita limitation it gets. Now it's been since raised to $1,500 or thereabouts, which was, I think, about $30 million they get from tax receipts imposed on oil company property. The other money they get, they borrow from New York to build an incredible capital improvements program. And while the state is sat stalled, unable to spend their money on capital improvements in the villages, sometimes 4 and 5 year lag, the borough has had an incredible, $200-$400 million a year in capital construction up there, which has had the salutary effect, of course, of keeping everybody employed. It's Cash City in the North Slope Borough, particularly Barrow. everybody or every family has a good paying job or two contributing to its welfare. And most of those are for the capital improvement program. I think that the Morrisville Borough at any given time has 500 or 600 people, most of the local citizens, were employed at five, most of that money borrowed from New York and essentially paid back by the state. As the 20 mills has been eaten into, the borough is now getting most of those 20 mills. And before the legislature, now is legislation to take the tax limitation off of Burnsville Borough entirely. The economic impact of that kind of money has resulted in the construction of damn near everything they need, or the planning of that, but it's also put the whole town of Barrow on Prudhoe Bay economy. It costs you, what, $100 to stay at a bunkhouse at Prudhoe Bay, and Willie's hotel there costs about how much are you charging there? In Barrow, it costs about the same. Oh, yeah, we don't. Yeah, $100 to stay in a hotel, you don't get food. So that's the way the economy is. You see, the whole North Slope economy has had to adjust itself to the economic Disneyland of Prudhoe Bay, sort of swept across. That's why NARL, the Naval Arctic Research Lab, is closed, because scientists can't afford the daily fee of doing business there, because it's been escalated to match that the economic facts of Prudhoe Bay, the wages and so forth paid, the fees by Arctic Services, RCA Arctic Services, what is it? ITT Arctic Services. International Telephone and Telegraph. So as a result, the nation's only research lab has been closed simply because they can't afford to pay it. So that's the impact. But so far, the borough's payroll has enabled the people up there to stay ahead of the savage economics of the North in terms of its inflation. The borough, having secured its right to exist and getting the capital improvement program going to provide housing, that's what Hobson said was the biggest problem, housing. It was. Since then, of course, the borough has built about 500-600 units of new housing. Fine, glorious houses, look like they might have been designed for Southern California, well insulated. But who gives a damn, because you see, in the meantime, Barrow, Gasfield, they found enough gas to keep Barrow wallowing in gas for 200 or 300 years. Barrow's gas is sold to them at something like 50 cents per 1,000 cubic feet, as opposed, for instance, to a couple of dollars in Anchorage, and sometimes $5 or $6 in other parts of the country. So Barrow will always have energy to maintain and heat the great capital plant that it's been able to build as a result of the cash coming in. This also, of course, grew slowly as Hobson developed the staff. His staffing up there has always been small simply because he's not been able to house new people. Now, they have many buildings now, apartment buildings, devoted to staffing, to housing North Slope Borough staff. As more and more whites come up now, but some people estimate that Barrow may have 40% white population. 40%, yeah. But all that hadn't happened yet, and we're still building schools, starting homes back in, say, 75, when all of a sudden we get a phone call from Sam Roddy, a dynamic, charismatic, but blind Eskimo leader from Inuvik, who said, "Eben, they're about to issue a drilling permit for some company to go offshore and drill offshore over here. You know, is there anything you can do to help us?" And so that got Eben into his international politics. He realized that when we looked into it, the American oil industry was being allowed to sort of experiment in Canada, get away with projects over there they couldn't get away with over here. And that resulted several years later in the organization under the under Willie's leadership of the United States Circumpolar Conference after two, one in 1977 and last year. In Greenland, they organized the Inuit Circumpolar Conference for the purpose of perhaps getting everybody to adopt the same set of rules offshore. And that was merely part of, was one of the results of Eben Hobson's habitat protection program. He recognized that
And as the courts had recognized when there were these early challenges, that probably the primary responsibility of the North Slope Borough is to protect the regional habitat upon which the people are going to have to depend for survival after the oil and gas is all gone. Of course, now we know, as far as they're concerned, it'll never be gone. There may be not enough to ship out, but there'll always be enough up there to fuel whatever industry, whatever buildings, whatever. They're going to have enough energy there, but that wasn't really part of his thought. His thought was that someday the airplane isn't going to come anymore. The whole system's going to break down, and they would like to be able to then rely upon the same thing they've relied upon for all these centuries, and that's a lot of, you know, their whale and the caribou. So I would say that Hobbs's primary focus was on politics that would enable him to defend the his habitat, and that resulted in an illegal defense program about which you've heard. We've gone to sue, gone to court to sue against offshore oil and gas, and against the business with the whale. The bowhead whale was kind of a collateral oil-inspired issue. You get into that, that was interesting politics, but I understand somebody has talked to you about it before. But the threat to the bowhead whale and the threat to the habitat offshore was enough to bring great solidarity behind Hobson and to keep the government strong, even though during the last 2 years of his government he didn't have much to do with it because he was so sick. Today, with Hobson being gone, he was replaced by kind of a centrist candidate, a young man who hadn't offended anybody much. But everybody thought he was a nice kid and perhaps had leadership capability. Everybody agreed also that now was not the time to squabble. Everything was, everybody felt that there ought to be a unity, and there was one more year remaining in Hobson's tenure. So they said, well, let's put the kid in and see how he does for a year. And now there's going to be, for the first time in the North Slope Borough, a major political fight between two sides, between the right and the left, between the Republicans and the Democrats, between the pro-developers and those who look upon development as if inevitable, not a good thing, and certainly nothing to be nothing to cooperate with. And that the reconciliation of that will be over in October, and I expect the borough strong enough to survive a real election. It'll be but that election will pretty much determine whether the North Slope Borough is going to be able to maintain its reputation as a leader in environmental and cultural defense, or is it just going to return and focus more or less upon the traditional things of local government, collecting trash and so forth and so on. At the same time, North Slope Borough was organized. We organized a school district, and pretty much the same thing has happened with the North Slope Borough School District that happened with the RIAAs. It was the same incompetent people who ran the schools for the BIA stayed on to work for the state, stayed on to work for these RIAAs, and they, of course, stayed on to work for the North Slope Borough School District. The North Slope Borough School District spends more money per student than any other school system in the world, by far. It doesn't allow those results. Kids don't know how to read, they don't know how to write, they're alienated. It's a completely failed system, you know, and it's a disgrace. So I guess local government and local control doesn't mean that you're going to have a good school system unless you can start all over and hire your own teachers. I think it's kind of a social problem. Teachers hire teachers. The original court got it. Red Bank Institution in the summer. That's what you have 10 years later, Red Bank Institution in the South. Specifically four or five towns in Texas. They produce many retired school teachers in these places, and they come up and they look upon the Eskimos as a challenge for special education. They go around looking for people who taught mentally retarded kids to come up and teach the kids up in Barrow. That's what they look for. Oh, you've had experience teaching mentally retarded kids. Well, you'll do well in Barrow. That was an expectation. The one of the sustaining political themes up there has been the recovery in the strength of language, and the language politics, also cultural politics, are very strong. The borough has a language commission. The language commission spends a lot of $5 million a year trying to produce materials. It's failed, of course, because the school district absolutely pays no attention to it. And the Commission on History and Culture, which has played a very important role in identifying lands traditionally used and by whom and for what, which became the basis for our coastal zone management program, is required to prevent oil companies from, we're trying to regulate where oil companies can operate. We can't operate here because you want to protect that for biological reasons or cultural reasons, but you can do it over here. And for that reason, for instance, posted out of bounds, absolutely can't do anything on a place called Cross Island. Also, taken, we don't want anybody to go north of the barrier islands because that'd be madness. And this is all based upon the work of the Commission on History and Culture, in which people actually went out and paced the land and said, yes, my family has hunted here, over here, and so forth. Now it's identified. So we put the plan all around that information. Now, of course, the North Slope Borough has been unable to get the State Department of Natural Resources or anybody else to cooperate with the Coastal Management Program. So that's what's been a serious challenge to a local government's power to plan and zone. Sacred rights, local governments in America, are being challenged because the state says the Eskimos do not have the right of the North Slope Borough to determine where the oil companies can and cannot operate on their own leases. Land and water use are state concerns, and therefore fall beyond jurisdiction of the North Slope Borough. So that's what the whole jurisdictional fight about up there. And of course, if you don't have that, you're not having precisely what the judge said the borough existed for, which was to regulate land and water use to preserve the eternal, you know, ecological integrity of the whole region, which is tied in. But the state's is challenging that. Now, there was a time before Evan became ill that challenging would be stopped because it would raise so much fuss. But nobody's making much of a fuss of it anymore. I think you find the borough leaders are sort of knuckling into that, accepting the limitations they find. Limitations basically in cooperation with state agencies. The borough is going to make another stab at getting a coastal management program approved. And if that's approved, then that means the state is, and the federal government has agreed on a management plan for the Arctic coast. And if that's approved, then we'll have the basis for consistency to hold the federal government. Because you have to understand, most of the land in the North Slope Borough is managed directly by the Bureau of Land Management or the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Arctic Wildlife Range to the west and the National Petroleum Reserve are great chunks of land which fall out beyond, I mean, they're not managed by state agencies, they're managed by federal agencies. And so therefore, we're trying to come up with a plan on state land, which of course is at Prudhoe Bay, the only oil-impacted piece of coastland in Alaska, and say, look, everybody agrees this is the way you operate, so therefore, we want to hold the federal government liable to be consistent with this on federal land on either side of what we call the Mid-Beaufort Coastal Zone between the Canning River and the Helvig River, further over. So that's what the Coastal Management Program is all about. I can't think of any other political curiosity about the borough at all. The borough is also maintained and hasn't been challenged by anybody as right to supervise and approve any activities of game wardens. Game wardens cannot go into the North Slope Borough and practice their trade. They can't go in and arrest anybody or anything like that until they check in with our police department and get a permit. Their permit comes upon a plan. They have to say what they want to do there, who they think is illegally hunting, and so forth and so on. And we take that plan to the mayor. The mayor looks at it, and if he thinks it's appropriate, then he gives approval. Well, hell, nobody will do that. As a result, we never see game wardens up there. Recently, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission was able to negotiate with the federal government an agreement which sort of stops the grand jury investigation and turns over the enforcement of the whole quota thing to the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission itself. Thus, we have nipped in the bud the latest threat to enforce fish and game laws up in the North Slope borough. So we pretty much kept fish and game law enforcement out of our area and taken it over ourselves, oh, except that's probably illegal. Nobody's challenged us. I think that's very significant. Yes. Value of the tax base. Well, plus we got one of that formula. Remember, it was $1,000 and $1,500 for the formula. The formula turned out to be less than that. The formula turned out by the time they had to talk. So as a result, the borough was getting most of that 20 mills already between the formula and never could figure out, and the what do you call it, debt service on all the bonds. The borough buys $450 million of bonds every year. They must be the 30,000 bonds out there. That too, we get that money comes in addition to everything else, plus revenue sharing and that sort of thing. We have a, I think the borough budget now is about $100 million operating budget. I can remember the state, that was half the state. We knew it was still, that was a half the state's operating budget.
That was all of the state's
Well, that doesn't include our capital program, which is, as I say, $200-300 million a year. Most of which, of course, goes to Seattle. Any other questions?
If the borough budget
back, well, the Constitution separates that out, and besides which, the really is found out. Schools are neglected. All the rules, you're supposed to stay out of, in fact, the mayor is supposed to stay out of the business of schools. In fact, Evan didn't. In fact, Evan asked the university to come in and help him set up a community college there, where he thought he could take the kids who were not being educated in the schools and maybe give them a second chance to be colleges. Of course, the university refused to do anything to the mayor. The result of Evan going to Antioch College to try to organize his own school. That came to Crawford when university finally decided they would serve Barrow, and they sent up a guy who subsequently, 2 or 3 years later, was found guilty of 12 counts of felony fraud for stealing and for issuing false and phony credit and pocketing the money sent to them by the university. Well, that's how the university has helped establish post-secondary education in Barrow. When asked recently if the university would join with others in an attempt to save the Naval Arctic, the Arctic Research Lab, the university president said, no, it would cost $3 or $4 million to try to keep my ticket money out of this other unit budget. So the university's record barrel is miserable, but it was a kind of an oblique attempt to see if we could at least influence the Texans who run the school system. Now, they, to their, for our astonishment, we have enormous numbers of native employees. Pedagogical servants. They are not allowed, there's no attempt to try to organize them up into actual teaching positions. They're sort of paraprofessionals. Many of them are unable to, there's no participation in work in Texas. As a result, the kids graduate literate in neither English or Eskimo. They talk baby talk in pidgin English, and they talk baby talk in pidgin Eskimo. And the parents wonder what the hell's wrong with them. Kids can't talk properly.
So there's a growing distance. And fortunately, these kids find jobs in the capital improvement program, for instance. They become carpenters, and they're able to earn a living. But I don't know what would have been there had it not been the borough provide the money to keep to provide jobs for the kids to come out of the school system. It's the obvious, not to be carpenters. Outside, shipped up, and maybe assembled them there, but only with local labor, and didn't care how long it took, or how much it cost. Well, out of that came a lot of very proficient carpenters, because that's how Evan got trained, you know, and Steve, that's how he earned a living as a carpenter. That's how he got into Lou Dishner. Lou Dishner, the relationship between the Thompson, and most of the borough, and Lou Dishner and Alex Miller, that started that way, because Dishner living in Fairbanks, organized the Carpenters Union, you know, because of the construction. His the Fairbanks area for the Carpenters Union took in all the new line construction. So he went out, Lou Dishner is from Fairbanks. He's about 65 years old, and he's considered the most shadowy and the most influential of Alaska's legislative lobbyists. He started his degree, his career at Influence Peddling as the head of the Carpenters Union here, and he organized his Carpenters Union behind a heavy core of native carpenters. Brought them in, made sure they got trained as carpenters. And these guys became his core. You could come here and tell the carpenters in Fairbanks, who were shifting the itinerant bunch anyway, screw off, right? He really had faithful folks out there and returned him to the Secretary of Treasury of the Carpenters Union at any time. That was the relationship we had with Abbott and Belts and the rest of them. They broke into the carpentry business on the new line system. And so when the legislature was asked by the governor to sort of put the borough out of business, Dishner had to choose. Was he going to go to work for the oil industry? Because they would like him, obviously. He was, even then, he was in 73, considered the finest lobbyist. He went to work instead for the North Slope Borough, and has fought the industry and has not ever had any industry clients, oil industry clients. One tradition, people say that the North Slope Borough would have been torpedoed. The only reason he made that rather expensive choice between working for the oil industry or the lobbyists and the Eskimos is because of his relationship with Evan Hobson, dating back to the Dewline days and the Carpenters Union, and also Alex Miller, because Dishner was always kind of a partner with Alex Miller, who was also a Fairbanks boy, used to be in the bar business and other businesses, and became respectable, worked for Deacon, and now is the vice president of Alaska International Airlines, which flies the aforementioned pre-constructed materials from Seattle up to Barrow in these Herks. One of the things that Hobson was able to do is he's able to build his own transportation system, and literally bought, paid for Alaska International Airlines, as well as sponsored annually the largest sea lift around the Arctic coast. Other than that, which sometimes was assembled to provide buildings and so forth, either oil, separate one, called peacetime domestic sea lift.
delivers $200-300 million worth of materials. You know, I think you could recognize the politics in all this, right? Here we have Barrow spending $200-300 million for capital improvements as construction, as engineers, and I'm talking about the most corrupt professions in the state, engineers, architects, and so forth, right? They learned their bad habits, of course, with the state. And so there was constant fighting with these people because they're constantly stealing from us, because they're unprincipled men and women. And Hobson was the only guy, by virtue of his strength, was able to hold it together and put together the great sea lift in the end and the air. He had all this sort of thing going. Fortunately, the young man is mayor now, he's trying to tear it all down, doesn't approve of it. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is sort of bought and paid for by the oil industry. Evan had a protege, a guy who had been away a long time and then came back. His name was Joe Hinkinson. While he was gone, he became a Republican. Wherever he was, where he worked, down below, he was a Republican. He comes back, and he starts, and for a while, he, and before he left, he and Hobson were sort of working together as friends, and when he came back, he decided Hobson was a Democrat. And so they started splitting up assignments, and Joe Hinkinson, he picked some, at the time, Land Claims Settlement Act was passed, was chairman of the Arctic Slope Association. So he sort of succeeded to the leadership of the guys who were going to organize the regional corporation, just like really what they reached out to John Schaefer and said, now shall be the president of this thing called the NAP. And you know, so it was really a very personal reaching out and giving assignments. Louis, John Schaefer wanted to become head of the DIA and no, because he didn't like it in the National Guard. And Willie said, what do you want to do after work? I got this thing called MANA about to happen, and you want to run it because we're going to need somebody to do it. So it was a very informal thing. Joel Pinson over here, Hobson, he broke off, and he sort of spent full-time organizing in Moscow Borough. And the Bukhiyar Community Corporation, also created by the Land Claims Settlement Act for Barrow. Organized by the same people who organized the regional corporation. It's kind of a leftover business and everyone board and so forth. It was very inactive kind of person. Either that's the right thing or so. These are the main players though up there now. As the land claims, land distribution and so forth has developed. Joe Pinson being a Republican, he immediately fired, who's a lawyer? Fred Paul had this client called the Arctic Slope Native Association, helped to organize the North Slope Borough and this. And Fred Paul lost his clients to an outfit in Seattle, and I don't know exactly what happened there, but anyway, Wickwirenberg sort of replaced Fred Paul, a nice Republican firm, and they sort of selected a guy by the name of Larry Dineen, who was an out-of-work consultant, to come up and sit with sort of help him become his administrative assistant, help him organize a regional corporation. So while that's going on, the North Slope Borough has been organized. They had his house over there, one desk, in a little office on top of the fire hall, no money, the oil company's suing him, you know, and he's quitting his job, and he's not got enough money for his salary. He's over here. Of course, these two organizations don't exist. Now, as you know, the land claims in that settlement enabled people at the last minute, people like Willie and others, to start creating villages. These are villages that may have once existed, but they didn't at the time. But as long as they're mentioned in the Land Claims Act, you know, they are potentially able to participate in land settlement distribution and so forth, cash distribution. It's also, in the North Slope Borough, that meant to reclaim the villages of Atkinsook, Lewixit, and the Point. Point Leg. These are three villages that once existed, mostly whaling camps, but they people in Barrow had been born in these places. A lot of them would like to go back, but how could they go back? They had to have housing. And so the great housing competition between the North Slope Borough and the Regional Corporation when the Regional Corporation very quickly threw up a lot of houses in Point Lake and the Wixon. But Evan said, well, damn it, don't you understand? Housing is the borough responsibility. And he had his own housing plan. And so that's the first note of discord that I ever heard in the North Slope Borough. Corporation. I remember I was up in Barrow and once Thompson stormed out of a little house that was devoted to headquartering the Lexington Regional Corporation. They argued with me about how it was read. Because the problem was that the guys who were assembled to organize this, you know, had worked together in ASMA and so forth, went on to become the board members of this corporation, were the same ones that were elected to sit on the Borough Assembly of this corporation. And so you have these guys, and in the process, Joe Pixon just couldn't stand Hobson. And Hobson couldn't stand that stiff Pixon. In spite of that, Gordon Pixon, president of this thing, and his mayor of this, that the executive committee of this sits on the Borough Assembly of this. And we saw Gerald McKee talk about that, how the borough was under the influence. The excessive influence of the corporate leadership here, but it was counterbalanced by a strong mayor system. Hobson being a strong mayor at the time he wasn't driven. So they said it could be bad, but it's not bad because Hobson's strong is able to keep it balanced out. Well, so the war began. Now, at the regional corporation, now, this is how the Republicans moved in on the corporation. They went out and got the young leadership. You know, for a long time, the older native guys would look upon the land claims as a fool's errand. I mean, they knew they owned the land. There was no question about that. Shit, they've been saying that for a long time, and nobody's paying any attention to it. So all of a sudden, I mean, if the land claims are going to go, they've already been, you busted your pick on this, in lesser claims with other authorities earlier on. So they let the kids make the charge this time. So the kids wind up in power here. Now, like, for instance, Jake Adams. Jake Adams returns from Mount Edgecombe, a bright kid, was taken immediately into the school district, the IA school, and made a teacher aide, right? And he is known, he's a boyhood friend of Oliver Levin, a little older guy, who's also one of the founding board members of the Regional Corporation, also a Republican, a very Republican. And so there's old friendships, and they sort of coalesce around the ground and put this together. And at the age of, I don't know, young age, in his early 20s, Jacob is made vice president of this regional corporation for lands. And he's placed under the vicarage of Tom Kelly. Tom Kelly was commissioner of Walter Hickel's commissioner of natural resources. And as such, was a leading spokesman against the land claims movement. He came right out and he said, well, maybe they got a little money coming, but God, we shouldn't give them any land. Whoever heard of giving people land because of aboriginal claims. And that was the state's position until Hickel went to Interior and Miller was defeated by Egan for re-election. The chief spokesman. And go back to the newspapers and see what he said, go back to the records and so forth. Very typical Texan racist, right? Couldn't stand the idea. And it was bashful about saying, you know, sort of identified himself as the hardest kind of the John Foster Hague of the state government. He becomes the artist of the Regional Corporation's chief land consultant. He's the one who works with Jacob Adams through Larry Devine, who was placed, as I say, by this law firm, the Wickwire firm, because they wanted to have a man. So the name comes up and works with Joe Pixon, and it sort of goes into the job of executive vice president, which, to his credit, he had the longest tenured White, executive vice president of the Native Corporation in the state. Paid something over $100,000 a year, and nobody knows how well the corporation is doing. I can't comment on it. I hear a lot of rumors, but I don't know how well they're doing. Yeah, well, they're all losing money, although many of them say they're making money. Basically, they're all losing money. You don't know if this is losing more or less than that. The war between the board, executive board of this, continues here as Oliver Levitt, treasurer of the regional corporation, becomes president of the North Slope Borough Assembly, and David Adams follows the line. They're elected by people, so. And the war goes on until basically everything's sick of two people to decide for him. But also, at one point, Oliver Levitt is defeated for re-election here and replaced by Jacob Adams. And the tone of the war tones down. And then also about that same time, Joe Pickson is defeated for re-election as president and replaced by Evan's brother, Edward, older man. And so the war tones down between as Evan and Edward try to get everybody to work together. And the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation begins to get contracts from the North Slope Borough. One such contract is the school. I think the school started out as a $12 million project. Now we're going to have a high school in Barrow. $50 million. Now people say it's only going to be $40 million. However, I'm told it'll probably be more like $50 million. That was one of the contracts that was given to the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation to set up a joint venture with the Anthony's Construction Building. One of the problems, of course, with the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is they try to make a profit, so they don't hire any locals, or as few of them as they can. One of the problems of giving the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation a contract is because it really means that there's not going to be as much employment in town as if you to get around to it, because the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation has to deal with the unions, the craft unions. Now, in order to avoid the problem of the unions, Thompson set up his entire capital improvement program so that anybody who works in government or anything else, they were a borough employee. They were a public employee, and they paid them, however, the going rate paid to construction workers in the union. So that's how he dealt. They always tried to organize contracts that would have that feature. Whoever the contractor was had to hire locally, and he would use the borough's employees. But that isn't something that Hobson, before he died, was able to get the regional corporation to do. So now we see today, over the years, we see the regional corporation goes into resource development and makes deals with oil companies and so forth to explore its lands. Begins to get prepared for OCS. The OCS opportunity. Hobson over here is trying to keep the industry from going offshore, crimping their ability to negotiate for business, providing an opening for guess who? And Julie and I had a bit of an argument. And we had a situation where here's the coast, and here's a bunch of islands, and we're saying, at least you can lease here. That's what the boroughs say. The villages are saying, absolutely not, you can't lease here. The boroughs say, you can't lease out here beyond the borough of Barrier Island. And the sale, of course, is being scheduled for this entire area, right? And here's the island. And we were scaring the hell out of them. All kinds of solidarity going. We were even looking. We were even looking reasonable to the oil companies because the villagers were in court saying, not even within the Barrier Islands can you drill. We were saying, hey, listen, we got a draw line somewhere. We can make a case for safety within the Barrier Islands, but beyond the Barrier Islands out here, the police out here, you're recording a disaster. And we were hoping that all the corporations in the AFN would join us in this because this was a test case to find out we really did have the power. And native people to keep people out of habitat where it would be real dangerous, where the bowhead whale went through. And the question was, were the Eskimos allowed, going to be allowed to organize local government? And if so, were they going to be allowed to tell the oil companies and the government where to lease and where not to lease and where to drill and where not to drill? You know, was their planning and zoning authority really strong enough to keep the people from doing stupid things like leasing out here? And that's what the Coastal Management Program was all about. And we raised, the people really felt that way, so of course the ASRC wasn't even able to negotiate joint ventures that had anything to do with the offshore. But that didn't keep Willie from negotiating. Just about the time we thought we had solidarity and everybody was going to support us, suddenly we hear that Will has led his corporation and three of our village corporations out from under us to 1%. I call it the great 1% solution. At 1% of, and without noise, you know, it's not only a political blunder, but it's also a theological blunder. He got them, I mean, they talked Willie into leading three of our village corporations into a joint venture so that each corporation, the village and Willie and so forth, would get 1% each, where I think it was a total of 4% of the action between the four corporations. That would be 4% of the oil that comes off the track, right? In addition to that, we went around shopping around for joint ventures and drilling projects that could be, in addition, you know, to the income from the track, he'd also get money from drilling on the track. And he signed an agreement with with British Petroleum, to do that. And the thing is, Willie didn't know which tract was his tract. He exposed himself to the danger of bidding with the oil companies on any of these tracts. Now, as it turns out, we scared the hell out of them, so not very many bid north of the Barrier Islands, you know, but it could have been, as it is, bid over here within the Barrier Islands, on one of the islands itself. So that's those that he went in with and won. So here we are, the North Slope Borough, trying to protect our habitat from what we consider to be premature oil and gas development, trying to establish the principle that yes, we can keep them off, and they can go here and set it here and so forth, and regulate what they do and how they do it, and make sure it's safe, protect the environment, racket-a-racket-a-racket-a-racket-a, and all of a sudden, we turn around and Kotzebue has said, and all of a sudden, other regional corporations started. God knows if Doyon, Doyon didn't, because of course, the man who had kept the faith was still in charge of Doyon, so Doyon didn't desecrate this, didn't commit this great sacrilege. But the Kodiak people did, and of course, the Sea Alaska. And so they came in. And so what did we have? We didn't even have the support of the AFN. We had nobody's support in our attempt to tell people to stay the hell out of the north of the Barrier Islands. And the villages, of course, the very villages which were in court suing, you know, I guess even going in here, that's part of the village, he went out and got other village leaders to sign up to this joint venture, which of course would mean they either drill out here or here, and certainly in violation of the express, or at least the representative interests of the village as they appeared in court. I regard that treachery as the reason why our coastal management program never went, because it simply didn't have the political support of Alaska's native leaders. And therefore, Evan could easily be sequestered and isolated over there